Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospels that have been used during the liturgical year of the Church. And the Gospel that we're going to take a look at today is Matthew chapter 10, verses 37 to 42. Jesus is discussing with his disciples both mission and discipleship, that we have something really pretty interesting that we have to deal with. Because this Gospel of most Gospels, but this one in a very particular way, has a very biting edge to it as far as our own culture goes, and as far as our own contemporary understanding of religion is concerned and faith is concerned. We paint a very broad stroke culturally with the idea of religion, and it includes not only the authentic revelation of God through Jesus Christ, but we incorporate that in cultural terms, any kind of personal held beliefs that seem to have some kind of a public expression, in either private or most generally some kind of communal form. And so we take those and we lump those together and we use kind of the same paintbrush for everyone. But as a matter of fact, that can't really be done when we're talking about the faith in which we believe and the kind of discipleship which we ourselves have been given the opportunity to pursue. So the Gospel starts out with Jesus instructed the 12 as follows: anyone who prefers father or mother to me is not worthy of me. Anyone who prefers son or daughter to me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me in my footsteps is not worthy of me. Anyone who finds his life will lose it, and anyone who loses his life for my sake will find it. Now, this has so many implications in it. But the bottom line, the fundamental proposition here that Jesus is offering the 12 is that when you opt to become a disciple of Jesus, in other words, when you opt to give your life to God Himself who has given it to you, then when that happens, that has implications for you in your world and in your life. We go back to the story of the apostles, and certainly there was a very interesting book out, and I don't even remember the name of it now, but it was the Legend of the 12 Apostles. And basically what it does is goes back and traces down all the ancient legends, all the ancient stories concerning what the fate and the destiny of the apostles were. And with some of the apostles, of course, there was the question of, before they followed the Lord, had they been married, did they have families and so forth? Well, we know the story in the Gospel of Peter's mother-in-law. We never hear of a wife and we never hear of children. And we never encounter them, but we do encounter his mother-in-law. So the presumption is that Peter was at least married. Whether he was widowed or what the situation was, we really don't know. There's also legends concerning Philip's daughters and all of this kind of thing. But what becomes clear and interesting is in the Gospels, we encounter Peter's mother-in-law, but we never encounter her again. And we never encounter a wife, or we never encounter children. That somehow or other, this discipleship of Peter with Jesus is in some way or shape or form an exclusive reality, not in the total exclusion of other people, for certainly they go to Peter's mother-in-law's house for, in order to have hospitality and so forth. So it isn't like there's this hard edge. It isn't like there's this bad relationship. We know that Philip did his ministry on his own, and we know that we find him legend-wise in many different places. We certainly don't hear of families in relationship to the rest of them, and certainly not in relationship to John, who is presumed and considered certainly to be a celibate. We never hear anything about James's family either. So whatever the situation was, what becomes clear in the New Testament is that these men's lives were the life of disciples, of apostles of the Lord. And that's what defined them, and that's what drove them on their journeys. And that's what, you know, we know again the stories of Thomas going to India, Andrew to Armenia, James to northern Spain. Is any of this true or not true? There's evidence to indicate that there is some truth to it, but certainly it is not a formal history at all. Paul, we know of his journeys, and we certainly know that Paul himself is also a celibate, as was Jesus. And so, so what happens then is what emerges in Jesus is talking to them is what their life is all about in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And it is, in some ways, exclusive. Not saying that there is no friendship, no anything like that in their personal lives, but that's not the center point. That's not the defining piece of their lives. And then when we hear anyone who prefers mother or father to me is not worthy of me, anyone who prefers son or daughter to me is not worthy of me, anyone who does not take his cross and follow my footsteps is not worthy of me. So what he's saying is that discipleship with him is whatever worth, whatever price it is that we are asked to pay. How many people found great resistance in following their particular vocations, especially in the priesthood and religious life, but also in marriage, to marry people that their families disapproved of and all this kind of thing. And yet we find that in pursuing that which is truly their vocation, they experience a kind of freedom and a kind of depth of human spirit that they would never have otherwise had they capitulated simply to the expectations of their age. In our modern age, we have a very, very kind of particular problem with all of this. And that is, it has become in vogue for the parent always to capitulate to the demands of the child culturally and morally and to accept them as they are, without ever withholding that kind of approval for unacceptable behavior, lest, in fact, they alienate the child and lose their child. Well, you know, in a way, in a strange sort of way, that's a one-way street. And that, in a strange sort of way, is also a kind of blackmail. Why must the parent always accept the moral and life decisions of their child when their child is not mature enough or caring enough to accept the values and the lifestyle of its mother and its father? It is actually then it is an unjust, relationship that develops between the petulant child and the indulgent parent. For the parent themselves has their own set of moral values, their own set of cultural values. And to accommodate then to what the child does by capitulating. Now, what the relationship could be if both parties held to their line but did not reject each other as human persons, that's another story. But that's not usually what happens. What happens is the pressure and the bullying of the child changes the position of the parent. But listen to this, then. Listen to the gospel. Anyone who prefers father or mother to me is not worthy of me. Anyone who prefers son or daughter to me is not worthy of me. Anyone who does not take up his cross and follow in my footsteps, anyone not willing to suffer for the sake of what they truly believe to be true and what is part of the revelation of Jesus Christ to his people, any of that is oftentimes a cross and a difficulty in our lives, a pain in our lives. Can we carry that? Should we carry that? How do we resolve these interfamily, intrafamily difficulties, stresses, and strains? But one thing was total capitulation on the part of the parent is not an acceptable way to live their own lives or even to assist the child and finding some kind of stability, some kind of footing, some kind of depth within their own lives. For anyone who finds his life will lose it. In other words, eventually, this is more oriented, I would say, toward the rebellious child than toward the parent, because what they're doing, it's, you know, the Billy Joel song, "I don't care what they say about me, it is my life," or Frank Sinatra's, you know, "I did it my way." That's not a formula for an intense and deep personal development and growth in relationship to our origin and to our destiny. For that is who we are. We are those who come forth from God. We are those who are destined to God. That is our identity. How we deal with that tells us who we're going to become and how we're going to lead our lives. We find this not just in the intrafamilial business, but we find it even culturally. How dare we be out of step with the tremendous force and pressure of modern culture, driven by media particularly, but also by politicians and just the lives of entertainers and all of this kind of non-essential components of our world, of our life, of our personhood. How, in fact, then, do we, if we seek to find our life as is identified by popular culture, Jesus says to us, we will lose it. But anyone who is able to find themselves in the truth of their own being, in the truth of their own relationship to origin and destiny, anyone finding it there will actually find the meaning of their life and find eternal life. So Jesus is setting up something that, while it sounds in some ways of Luke's gospel is much more harsh, if you don't hate your mother and your father, he said, but Matthew's not doing that. Matthew's saying anyone who prefers father or mother to me, anyone who prefers anything of the created order to the origin of that created order is not worthy of discipleship with the Lord. Now, we find this all the time. And in finding this all the time in our culture, we have false gods thrown before us at every turn. Now, some of those false gods are legitimate and worthy causes, but they are not gods. They are worthy and legitimate if we integrate them into the whole picture of creation. If we isolate them and pursue them as something which is the end-all and be-all of our existence, then somehow or other we have turned from that which is legitimate to that which is idolatry. I think in so many ways all the issues concerning the environment, there is a very, very deep responsibility on the part of human nature to care for the created order. It is mandated to us in Genesis. It is mandated to us in the very fact that God has created it and that it is a thing of beauty coming forth from Him. And to distort that, to destroy that, to exploit that, and so forth, is grievously sinful. But it is grievously sinful not because it threatens our existence, because life itself is a threat to our existence. Crossing the street in heavy traffic is a threat to our existence. That, as a matter of fact, it is not in and of itself a god. It is not, and I don't know whether we're still into the whole Gaia, Mother Goddess Earth or not, kind of false religion that became very, very prevalent during the first wave of hysteria about global warming or not. But it has nothing to do with Gaia. It has nothing to do with the fact that the earth is useful to us. It has to do that it is a gift to us from God, and we dare not abuse God's gifts. And we must take care of them, exercise a prudent and reliable stewardship over them. And we must in every way then be respectful to all the things that belong to the Lord and that come to us from the Lord. But that's an example of trying to find an alternative to God that is worth the very fact that it becomes a form of pagan religion worship, delegitimizes it, makes it in many ways a foolish endeavor, makes it look and therefore polarizes people. And yet, somehow or other, this is a common need. This is a common responsibility. This is a holy thing that we do to care for the vestiges of the Lord in the midst of our world. And we dare not trivialize it, and we dare not abuse it, and we dare not in any way ridicule it. On the other hand, those who make it ridiculous are guilty of endangering the very thing that they desire to protect. Those who make environmentalism a ridiculous thing by divinizing their whole endeavor, by exaggerating, by using bad science, by all those kinds of things, they make it a less than credible reality for us. So it is in actually its relationship with God that we find the proper ordering of that. But that's an example, beyond just family, of the distortion that can go on in our choices and in our loyalties and in our understanding and our sense of ourselves. That we can substitute whatever we want, but that substitution ultimately ends up a historical absurdity. There is no one who's going to take the occult religion of the Nazis and say, wasn't that a noble effort? It becomes a source not only of horror, but of absurdity. Of course it is absurd to do those kinds of things. It is something that is dehumanizing. It is the loss of a life. In the end, Der Führer committed suicide. And in the end, what he gave his life to was so wrong and so false that it, in inside of himself, he lost anything that he had as a human person. So then he says, Jesus says, anyone who welcomes you welcomes me, and those who welcome me welcome the one who sent me. That it is the establishment of the community of believers. Anyone welcoming a fellow believer and is welcoming the Lord himself. And anyone who welcomes the Lord himself welcomes the Father as well, welcomes the one who sent him. So this bond of faith becomes one of the fundamental relationships of our whole existential life. Welcoming the Christian, welcoming the one who does actually believe in God, believe in the Lord. And then he says, anyone who welcomes a prophet because he is a prophet will have a prophet's reward. And anyone who welcomes a holy man because he is a holy man will have a holy man's reward. If anyone gives so much as a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he is a disciple, then I will tell you solemnly, he will most certainly not lose his reward. The ultimate focus of charity and is ultimately the believers. It is the community of believers. And we find this also in the letters of Paul. You take care of your brethren. You take care of the ones who travel this world with you in solidarity with Jesus Christ. This does not in any way exclude the possibility of good works for others, of charity for others, but that it is most authentic when it is a charity that is manifested and expressed in a solidarity of discipleship with the Lord. When we move beyond that, and certainly this was one of the great movements of the missionary movement of the church from the 16th century up until the middle of the 20th century, when it seemed just absolutely to collapse. But what happened was, it was those who brought the word of God, who also brought the kind of peace and harmony, and even that helped to create the basic fundamental material needs of life, to provide those as well in the world in which they went, in an attempt to integrate those whom they encountered into the body of Christ, into the community believers, and in so doing to help them to obtain those things in the world which were of necessity to them and of need to them. We know the stories of the missionaries and the betrayals and the intrigues and all of that kind of thing that went on. The great question of how much do you integrate into their culture, into their society, the tremendous contemporary criticism of the Society of Jesus in China and Japan, for instance, was intense back in Rome. Was it too much? Was it too much acculturation or not? Well, it's hard to tell. But the thing is, it was certainly effective. And as a matter of fact, in Japan, Christianity existed in the city of Nagasaki from the days of Francis Xavier to the days of the dropping of the atomic bomb on that city. It was something that lasted for hundreds of years and created a solidarity. When St. Maximilian Kolbe went to Nagasaki and brought with him his missionary endeavors in the name of the Mother of God, certainly it was well received, and it brought a great deal of solidarity among the Japanese Catholics with the Catholics of the West. In China, for instance, there was a great deal of success in the Jesuit missions in China, but the Franciscans and the Dominicans also came, and the Franciscans and the Dominicans also found success in the spreading of the gospel. As a matter of fact, very early on, there have been ruins of a Franciscan churches from the 13th century found in Mongolia. It's amazing how much and how far the zeal for the faith spread itself, even in such an early time and when these lands were so inaccessible to one another. It's a fact that when Mother Cabrini, who came to the United States under obedience, wanted to be a missionary, was terrified of water. And so she wanted to be a missionary somewhere where she could walk to. And so she requested to be a missionary to China, and figuring she would walk to China. But instead, the Holy Father sent her to the States, and despite her intense fear of the water, she crossed the ocean 9 times in obedience to the will of God and to the needs of her people here in the United States. So, yeah, there is heroism. There is great heroism. There is great sacrifice in this business of looking after those who are of the faith, bringing them into the faith, that they might experience this kind of solidarity with Jesus Christ and this kind of solidarity with the church throughout the world. And so what we find then is that the focus, first of all, is to the community of believers. Then we carry that as a sign of our faith in Jesus Christ into the rest of the world, but always to some degree with a missionary intention. We have to bring Christ. We can't just bring food. And it isn't that we bribe people to enter the church, but it's that they might experience a certain sense of abundance and solidarity among all of those people who are, in fact, disciples of the Lord, who do follow Jesus and who do take him at his word to look after people, his disciples, because they are his disciples. Now, there would be a lot of challenge to this, and I know it is a great debate. What do we do when we offer charity? Should there be some kind of religious component to it? Of course there should, but what should that be? I know one charitable institution, for instance, that, you know, they have to go through 3 hours of catechetics before they can get what they need. Well, they're not skilled and trained catechists, and they're speaking to people of things people can't understand. We don't realize how totally alienated the Word of God has become in modern culture. Even 20 years ago, 30 years ago in Appalachia, we were able to encounter people who had never heard of the Bible and never heard of Jesus as a person. So yeah, we can't sit down and and give some kind of structured catechesis to people who don't know what we're talking about. That's not exactly what I mean. But the idea of inviting them into prayer, the idea of praying where they can see us draw our strength from God in order that we might have that strength to give to them what we have, which is not just of ourselves, but of the Lord as well. There is this tremendous witness value. And Pope Paul VI in his Evangelii Nuntiandi said, you know, that the great teachers are the teachers who witness, not the teachers who speak. And I think that this idea of the Christian witness as being something other than an apparatchik and a charitable work is an important part of any of the charity that we give. First, we care for our own. Then we care for the rest of the world, but we do so as emissaries, as disciples of Jesus, and not simply as social workers or in social service. It's interesting that one of the foundresses of one of the great charitable orders of the last half millennium, St. Louise de Marillac, whose Daughters of Charity used to fan out over Paris, you know, carrying food and clothing and all of that kind of stuff. And she said, whatever you do, do not become do-gooders. What you are doing for Christ. And I do recall also when I was in the seminary in Innsbruck, one of that we would walk by the Capuchin monastery on the way to the university, and constantly in and out of the Capuchin monastery came friars with baskets on their back, fanning out into the poorer sections of the city, making sure that the people there were receiving some of the abundance of the land that belongs to the Lord, and in a sense then rightfully also belongs to them. But there was no question in anybody's mind as to why they were doing this. They were doing this because they loved Jesus Christ and had given their life to Jesus Christ completely. They had, as a matter of fact, living as many of those people lived, they had really preferred Jesus Christ to mother and father, to brother and sister, and sometimes to sons and daughters. The great example of that, of course, also is St. Jane Frances de Chantal, who had the horrible experience of having to leave her 15-year-old son when she felt God was calling her to an apostolic and deeply religious way of life. These are the struggles that we have, and these are the things that go on. But from it all, we glean this, that we prefer Jesus to everything else. We prefer him to everyone else. That doesn't mean we don't like anybody else. It doesn't mean we don't love other people. But we prefer Jesus. And when the choice comes, we choose Jesus. And when we choose Jesus, we also then support one another, care for one another, look after one another, take care of one another. And when it is all said and done, that way of losing our life is how we actually find out who we are. For the Lord dwells within us, and we discover him the more we give away of ourselves. Not only, then, I tell you solemnly, you will certainly not lose your reward. Let's think about some of these very real and very serious problems and ask the Lord to help us to understand the implications of this gospel in our own lives.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.